Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 561, titled Economics 911, Part 2, being recorded on July 16th of the year 2006. Before we get into the main body of the program, let me note that there is a vast and growing amount of information relevant to For the Record on the web, both audio files maintained both by Spitfire and by Heroic Sister Station WFMU. Those are available, and also a vast and growing amount of printed material, long article-length descriptions of the For the Record shows, old, long out of print, and copyright-expired anti-fascist books. So I can't encourage people strongly enough to take advantage of the enormous amount of material on the web, because those of you who only listen to the programs are only getting a small amount of the For the Record experience. Please note also that those of you who do take advantage of this information are most emphatically encouraged to use the internet and other means of public communication to disseminate this information. That's what it's for. I don't get paid for what I do, and the idea basically is we're all in the same boat. It is sinking with great rapidity, and we've all got to start rowing and bailing. Otherwise, basically, we're all going to be shark food. So that's my advisory under the circumstances, okay? Alrighty, more about that time permitting at the end of this side and on side two. Now, this program, again, part two of Economics 911, is going to be dealing with some of the economic implications of not only September 11th, but related topics, the ongoing turmoil in the Middle East and some of the economic implications of same. Now, last week, we talked about the free market, laissez-faire economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood and how basically it is at one with the desires of the multinational corporate globalists. And in my considered opinion, the multinational corporate community, not necessarily corporate America, but the multinationals, the transnationals, and the element that dominates them, the underground Reich, the most powerful economic entity on earth, those elements very much want to promote the Muslim Brotherhood in order to supplant state-controlled economies in various areas. Specifically, although the Bush administration is in certain respects opposing the Muslim Brotherhood, some elements of the Bush administration are actively supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and Bush's, quote, democracy, unquote, program has led to the ascension of the Muslim Brotherhood in a variety of different societies, either their accession to total power or their significant increase in parliamentary representation. I suspect that Islamist slash Muslim Brotherhood free market economic philosophies are targeted for areas like Syria, which still have a state-controlled economy, which is sort of like a hybridization of fascism and Stalinist socialism. So as a starting point for this discussion as well, we're going to talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, and we're going to review some of its fascistic ideology and connections. Veteran listeners will please bear with us here. I know you know about this, but this is a complicated line of argument. And indeed, For the Record is about as pedantic a radio broadcast as one could possibly want. And so in consideration of same, I'm going to repeat certain key points so that it's easier for people to keep them in mind. By the way, too, one should remember that political matters are not monolithic or simplistic. And if people are sort of confused by how elements of the Bush administration could be promoting the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamism in places like the Middle East, parts of the Middle East, and perhaps also at least some elements of U.S. intelligence appear to be backing the Islamists in Chechnya and in Xinjiang province in China in attempts to break off those mineral resource-rich parts of Russia and China, respectively. At the same time, one should not make the mistake that a lot of the conspiracy geeks, in particular the so-called the 911 BS movement, not the serious 911 researchers, but the BS, the controlled demolition freaks and their ilk, they are maintaining that that Osama bin Laden, etc., are simply extensions of the CIA. They were trained and armed by the CIA, but that was a long time ago. And we are indeed fighting a very, very real war with those same elements. It is, in certain respects, analogous to World War II, when American fighting men and women and the other Allied fighting men and women were engaged in a very, very real, incredibly costly, bloody struggle against the forces of fascism, while significant elements of the world's power elites, including the Bush family, among others, were in bed with the fascists. Indeed, at the same time as the elder George Bush was being shot down by the Japanese in the Pacific, his father, Prescott Bush Sr., was basically banking money for the Nazis. One should not oversimplify this, and if some of what I'm saying seems puzzling, bear in mind what happened in World War II, because with Islamofascism, as with fascism in the World War II period, many of the world's power elite, the corporate elite, are playing ball with the very people that our fighting men and women are bloodily engaged with. So that may be something of a help. Reviewing the fascist connections and, in particular, the fascist economic, the corporatist economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, we are going to go back to the book Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeuvière. Richard LaBeuvière published a remarkable book in French in 1999 and English in 2000, which in many ways not only anticipates the events of September 11th, but goes a long way towards helping to sort out some of the very confusing realities. We're going to begin here by taking a look reviewing some of the aspects of the Muslim Brotherhood. Before we get to the Brotherhood's corporatist philosophy, we're going to review some of the political history of the luminaries of the Muslim Brotherhood, including Sayyid Ramadan, the son-in-law of Brotherhood founder Hassan al-Banna, and also the father of Tariq and Hani Ramadan, who are being hailed by the so-called progressive sector in certain countries, including this one, as progressives, enlightened people, and so forth. They are nothing of the kind. And indeed, some of the savvy French counter-terrorist experts and investigators, certainly not people who could be called toadies of American imperialism, nor people who supported the preposterous Iraq invasion. Many of these individuals are hailing the Ramadans as heroes. In fact, they are nothing of the kind. Turning now to Dollars for Terror, of Sayyid Ramadan and the Muslim Brotherhood and their historical relationship to fascism, after discussing the fact that Sayyid Ramadan selected Munich as the eventual place for the Muslim Brotherhood to relocate in Europe, as well as Geneva, Switzerland, why Munich? Why Germany, I asked Rifat Sayyid. Because there, one finds old complicities that go back to the late 1930s when the Muslim Brothers collaborated with the agents of Nazi Germany. By soaking up the savings of these Muslim workers, meaning Turkish workers in Germany, Yusef Nada, like Sayyid Ramadan, took advantage of an extremely favorable context and used it as a springboard for the Muslim Brothers' economic activities. Yusef Nada, who calls himself the foreign minister of the Muslim Brotherhood, is the head of the Bank al-Taqwa, the Muslim Brotherhood's primary financial organ and an institution that helped to fund al-Qaeda, according to numerous sources. Yusef Nada was also a Nazi spy in World War II, and Yusef Nada, through the SAR network and the Safa Trust, busted on March 20th of 2002 in the Operation Green Quest raids. Those networks link elements of the GOP and the Bush administration to the Muslim Brotherhood and former Nazi spy Yusef Nada, continuing with Richard LaBeuvière's Dollars for Terror. But Yusef Nada is even better known to the Egyptian intelligence services, who have evidence of his membership in the armed branch of the fraternity of the Muslim Brothers in the 1940s. At that time, according to the same sources, he was working for the Abwehr under Admiral Canaris and took part in a plot against King Farouk. This was not the first time that the path of the Muslim Brothers crossed out of the servants of the Third Reich. The history of the fraternity makes the Brothers' concept of the Islamic State clear, a theocratic state of fascistic inspiration. Some of them were fellow travelers of the Nazis and are still trying today to resuscitate the old alliance of Islamism and the swastika. And the next reference here is to Mohammed Saeed al-Ashmawi. He is an Egyptian journalist who has been the focal point of a great deal of threatening behavior and even at some point incarceration for his opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood, despite the fact that the brothers themselves are less than completely welcome by the Mubarak government. Mohammed Saeed al-Ashmawi continued, quote, "All my research always brings me back to the same point. At the beginning of this process of the perversion of Islam are the Muslim Brothers, an extreme right cult." An extreme right cult? Quote, "The history of the Muslim Brothers is infused and fascinated by fascistic ideology," Saeed al-Ashmawi adds. "Their doctrines, their total if not totalitarian way of life, takes as a starting point the same obsession with a perfect city on earth in conformity with a celestial city whose organization and distribution of powers they can discern through the lens of their fantastical reading of the Quran." This fascistic affiliation, unquote, would crop up in the analyses of several of our interlocutors, in particular that of the journalist Eric Rouleau, who is a specialist in the Middle East and the former French ambassador to Tunisia and Turkey. Skipping down. Lastly, "The emergence and the rise to power of fascism, hostile to French and British colonialism, gave rise to many analogies with corporatist propaganda and the methods of mobilization of Mussolini's gangs," unquote. And more about the doctrine of Muslim Brotherhood founder Hassan al-Banna. "Islam is doctrine, divine worship, the fatherland, the nation, religion, spirituality, the Quran, and the sword." And more about the fascistic economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's again skipping down from Dollars for Terror. "Taking Italy's choices under Mussolini for inspiration, the Brotherhood's economic program set three priorities. The social policy foresaw a new law on labor founded on corporations. This economic program would more directly reveal its relationship to totalitarian ideologies a few years later with the works of Mohammad Ghazali. Mohammad Ghazali recommended, quote, an economic regimen similar to that which existed in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, unquote. The moral code is also an important component in this program, which is intended to create the new Muslim man, unquote. The notion of the equality of the sexes is inherently negated by the concept of the supremacy of male social responsibilities. The, quote, natural, unquote, place of the woman is in the home. That, again, by way of review of the corporatist slash fascistic economic philosophy at the core of the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood. It has been PR whitewashed, so to speak, to be more of a free market slash laissez-faire economic philosophy, but that, as often as not, leads to fascism in the long run after many of the powerful corporate interests wind up screwing themselves, which they often do, and the economy collapses, people freak out, and then somebody has to impose order in order to make the trains run on time. This, again, by way of supplementing what we looked at last week. Now, we're going to turn to some of the economic and macro-political implications of not only the turmoil in the Middle East, but even more importantly, the resulting rise in the price of oil. Now, I guess I should add at this point or interject that, like many people, as I observed the ongoing chaos and warfare and bloodshed in the Middle East, I wouldn't say I exactly took it at face value, but I wasn't looking deeply enough into it, whereas certainly the U.S. misadventure into Iraq appeared to be motivated by oil, and I suspect there's a more complex motivation there than it first appeared. In fact, I have come to believe over a period of time that it is the actual chaos in the Middle East, the violence in the Middle East, the terrorism from Al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood, related Muslim Brotherhood offshoots, the ongoing conflicts between the Israelis and the Palestinians and now the Hezbollah, the targeting of Saudi oil infrastructure, and in general, the saber-rattling vis-a-vis Iran on both sides in that confrontation. looking at that at a superficial level, I think one can miss the point. What I think is really important about that is that it is that very violence and instability itself which is, at a superficial level, leading to a massive increase in the price of oil. But that increase in the price of oil is a profound, an absolutely profound political and economic event, and it is leading to an enormous and what I believe ultimately might prove decisive shift in wealth. It is an enormous transfer of wealth from the coffers of everything and everybody on the face of the earth, because everything and everybody on the face of the earth uses petroleum directly or indirectly, into the coffers of not only the oil companies, but also many of the countries that produce petroleum. And that is a profound, profound event indeed. Suppose one were a criminal. Suppose what you want to do ideally is to mug everything and everybody on the face of the earth. Suppose what you wanted to do was to basically stick a gun in the face of everyone on earth and say, give me your money, give me your wallet. Well, obviously, you couldn't do that in the most literal physical sense. But if you send the price of oil scurrying upward, and boy, it's doing that, and the violence on all sides, Al-Qaeda, the Iraq chaos, the confrontation between Iran and the U.S. and others, the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian violence, and now the Israeli-Hezbollah violence, the effect of that is to create political instability in the Middle East, and the price of oil is soaring, and that increase in the price of oil is resulting in an enormous worldwide transfer of wealth. As I mentioned last week, and time permitting, we'll mention again later, in the early 1970s, the effect of the Arab oil boycott of the early 70s and the resulting price increase for oil, that was a profound economic and political event, and the strain that it placed on the various economies, in particular some of the center-left social democratic governments in Europe, the strain that it placed on everything and everybody, because every individual and every institution, public and private, uses oil, ultimately led to much of the right-wing reaction that swept not only Europe, but ultimately North America as well. Margaret Thatcher would not have come to power in England if it hadn't been for the pressure placed on the British socialist system by the oil price increases. When the strong labor unions in Britain began striking right and left, in order to get higher wages to match the greater costs they were incurring all over the place because of the increase in oil. And that increase in the price of oil leads to an inflation across the board, because everything uses oil to transport goods to market and or to manufacture goods. So the price of everything goes up, and when wage earners try to match those price increases with wage increases, it leads to the classic wage price spiral that ultimately helped to bring Ronald Reagan to power in the United States, and it brought Margaret Thatcher to power in England as well. Punk rock was an indirect outgrowth of the Arab oil boycott, because again, the increase in oil prices destabilized many of the center-left social democratic governments of Europe, and the resulting dissatisfaction, despair, and alienation on the part of many young people in those countries, in England in particular, the United Kingdom in particular, led to the form of musical social protest that punk rock was at its inception. So against that background, one should be taking a look at the increase in oil, which is coming from all of this violence and instability, and understand it for the profound and, I suspect, ultimately decisive political factor that it's going to become. We're going to review an article that we looked at last week. This is from the Financial Times of Monday, May 15th of 2006. An article from the Financial Times by Guy Dinmore in Washington. Its headline, U.S. must beware, unquote, rise in Al-Qaeda oil strikes. What this talks about is Osama bin Laden's plan to destabilize the U.S. by destroying its economy through increasing the price of oil. This reads, the U.S. and its Arab allies must expect an increase in attacks on their oil infrastructure in the next phase of the war by Al-Qaeda targeting the U.S. economy, the former Central Intelligence Agency official who was responsible for hunting down Osama bin Laden warns today. Writing for the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington security think tank, Michael Scheuer says Mr. Bin Laden's intention to bankrupt the U.S. economy by driving up world oil prices is very likely to lead to attacks inside the U.S. by al-Qaeda, its allies, or unrelated groups. Houston's gas refineries, oil import facilities, and ship canal and pipeline systems, and the Trans-Alaska pipeline are potential targets. Al-Qaeda's failed attack on Saudi Arabia's Abqaiq facility on February 24th, which led to a $2 a barrel jump in world oil prices, should also be seen as the beginning of a new and more systematic phase of targeting of the kingdom's oil infrastructure. 2 days after the attack, an Al-Qaeda-affiliated cleric issued a religious justification for attacking oil processing installations. The cleric, using the internet, also claimed that attacks on prominent Muslim oil officials were justified. The militant organization's media apparatus is also being used, quote, to stir the troubled pot of oil-related international worries, unquote, Mr. Scheuer writes, noting encouragement for Nigerian insurgents in the Niger Delta and Mujahideen, unquote, in the Caspian Sea region. Facing al-Qaeda's evolving strategy, Mr. Scheuer, who left the CIA in 2004, notes that Mr. Bin Laden has never threatened to cut oil supplies to the U.S. Instead, he is driven by the belief that Muslim oil is bought too cheaply. In December 2004, Mr. Bin Laden wrote that a minimum of $100 a barrel was a fair price, unquote. In his September 1996 Declaration of War Against Americans, unquote, Mr. Bin Laden argues that oil in the Islamic world is a treasure to be preserved for future generations of Muslims and thus should not be wasted through attacks. As a result, Mr. Scheuer says al-Qaeda's plans rule out attacks on oil wells, but focus on the infrastructure needed for refining and transporting oil, as well as industry personnel. Well, that speaks for itself, and we've read that article into the record last week, and indeed it'll be in the description for 560, which will be going up onto the Spitfire website within the next couple of days. But, again, let me stress that in watching the bloody events unfolding in the Middle East, think beyond the superficial level and think about what this instability and this violence in the oil-producing epicenter of the world is actually doing. It is leading to a huge increase in oil prices that is not only affecting an enormous transfer of wealth into the coffers of some of the most reprehensible interests on Earth, not only the petroleum companies themselves, but also the Saudis, the Holocaust-denying Iranians, and a lot of others. It is also collapsing, or it is placing greater pressure on those individuals and those institutions least capable of surviving the inflation that results from this. Relatively poor or people of modest income, institutions, nonprofit institutions in particular, or ones without a great deal of income, those are going to be, if not pressured, certainly if not eliminated, they are sorely pressured. And ultimately, a brutal sort of economic, petroleum-driven social Darwinism will take place, in which only those who are strong enough, i.e. rich enough, to afford the increase in the price of oil will survive. And everything and everybody else is going down. So keep that in mind. Sometimes doing this program, we're going to get back to the instability and its effect on the price of oil and the macroeconomic and macro-political implications of that. Sometimes doing this program is surreal. And one of the things, I read a lot of newspapers, and listening to some of the reports about, well, consumer confidence is up, I do not know how anybody could be confident about what's going on in the world economy. Everybody I know is hurting. And any consumer who has confidence is either filthy rich or nuts. There is a very scary but very important column that appeared in the Financial Times of Monday, May 1st of 2006. By the way, younger listeners, the Financial Times is sort of the primary economic journal of the United Kingdom, and it's an important reading source. This is an op-ed column by a Tennessee Democratic congressman, and what he's doing is talking about the difference between America's budget deficit as it's being reported by the administration and the reality of the American budget deficit. It reads in part, The federal government keeps two sets of books, but the Bush administration only wants you to see one of them. There is the highly publicized President's Budget issued by the Office of Management and Budget, and the almost secret Financial Report of the United States, unquote, issued by the Department of Treasury. The budget says that the 2005 U.S. fiscal deficit was $319 billion, but the financial report claims it is $760 billion. Which view is correct? Is the deficit a mere 2.6% of gross domestic product and shrinking, as the former OMB director and now White House Chief of Staff Joshua Bolton claims, or an alarming 6.2% of GDP and growing, as John Snow, Treasury Secretary, writes in the financial report? The budget that is hand-delivered to every congressman's and senator's office is calculated on a cash basis. That is, the government only counts dollars as they are received from taxpayers and spent by government agencies. This says the, quote, deficit, unquote, for 2005 was $319 billion. In contrast, the financial report was issued without a press release and measures government activity on an accrual basis, when income is earned or expenses are incurred, although no cash may have yet been transferred. According to the report, the U.S. obligated itself to spend $760 billion more than it collected from taxpayers in 2005, so the net operating cost was $760 billion, skipping down. The budget says that the national debt is $8.2 trillion. The report indicates that the present value of our obligations is more like $49 trillion. That unimaginable sum is how much money we must set aside today to pay the full Social Security and Medicare benefits that Congress has already promised. The budget says Americans' personal share of the national debt is $28,000. The report says it is $156,000. That means that a family of five owes roughly $750,000. As David Walker, U.S. Controller General, says, you owe your government the equivalent of a luxury home, only you do not get to live in it. You only get the mortgage. Yes, indeedy. And bear in mind not only the profound elements of connection between the GOP, Grover Norquist, Karl Rove and the Islamic Institute, and the Muslim Brotherhood, the parent organization of Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but note the synergy of policy. Who's doing a better job of collapsing the U.S. economy? Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden or George Bush? Or are they really both puppets being manipulated, as I believe, by the same elements, the underground Reich, which one banker told late journalist Paul Manning was the greatest concentration of money power under a single control in all of world history? Think about that, folks, next time you are paying your taxes. Think about it the next time you vote, too. Anyway, we're going to continue with our analysis of the macroeconomic and macro-political implications of the oil price increase in Side 2. This, however, concludes Side 1. Websites, www.spitfirelist.com, a wealth of printed information and audio information there. www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery and linked websites. There is a small universe of valuable, invaluable information about fascism and political science, both in audio form and in printed form. Basically, use it or lose it, folks. If you don't read, then you're going to bleed. If you don't study history, the world is a mystery. God knows I've made it easy enough for you to study history, albeit you've got to invest some time. And after, hopefully, you've invested that time, set aside a little more time to disseminate the information to others via the Internet. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 561, Economics 911 Part 2, being recorded on July 16th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.